I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. No question about it, student protests on college campuses have grown angrier and more disruptive in recent years. While the Columbia branch of the University of Missouri saw loud and contentious actions by students, here at UMKC, things remained surprisingly calm. Today we'll find out what's being done to promote cultural acceptance at the KC University and the steps that still need to be made. Also, using today's fringe to predict tomorrow's trends, we'll learn how a futurist thinks and what you should pay attention to before it becomes a big hit. Then Brian McTavish brings us the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The unrest witnessed at American universities and colleges in recent years is at a level not seen since the days of the Vietnam War. Notable among those institutions is the University of Missouri at Columbia. Frustrated with the school's lack of response to complaints of racism, exclusion, and lack of diversity, African American students and their allies organized and carried out a series of protests that at times were explosive and disruptive and made headlines across the nation. As a professor here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, I wasn't seeing any of that on this campus then or since, and I wondered why that is. Here today to talk about that are members of the UMKC student body and administration. Mohammed Wakas is with the Muslim Student Organization. Mohammed, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Remy Shah serves as Secretary of Pride Alliance. Remy, good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Susan Wilson is also here. She is UMKC's Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion. Susan, always good to have you, too.
Good morning, Steve.
I'd like to start with asking what your thoughts were to the protests as they developed on the Mizzou campus back in 2015. Mohammed, what went through your mind?
It was just a little sad to see all that happening. And the reason it was happening, it's not that far away, and we're really close by. And so when you see things on the news that happen far away, it's like, okay, whatever. But when it's happening in your own backyard or close by, it's a little frightening sometimes.
What made it, why were you sad about it?
We live in 21st century. At a time, you'd think that everyone could just tolerate each other and get along. But when that's not the case, it's just a little worrying to see that happening.
Yeah. Remy, how about your reaction?
So I'm actually a student from St. Louis, and my high school, Parkway North High School, was just a stone's throw away from the Ferguson-Florissant School District and the events that happened there. I was in high school when the events of two summers ago occurred regarding the incidents that occurred in regard to police brutality and whatnot. So this is an issue that's very close to me. The fact that I, and in my own school district, these individuals were considered, we fought very hard. And it was difficult because when you see your own peers and classmates find themselves fearing for their lives, having to do all these things perhaps other members of the community would not have to even think about, like how they get home at night, how to approach a police officer, all these different things. It's very concerning when you consider that it's happening even in our own administrations in the University of Missouri system. I don't think that's just I just don't think that's tolerable.
You know, Susan Wilson, again, who leads the diversity efforts at UMKC, what was the administration's response here in Kansas City? I mean, what message did the university get out to the students, and what services were offered here to give them a hand?
So first of all, some of our students were actually involved in terms of going down to support the students at MU. And so some of the support that we were very proud of our students, because one of the things that they were promoting was peaceful demonstrations, being respectful when you demonstrate. So we were very proud of our students and their participation, because our students felt called to support. We also, in the aftermath of the MU situation, set up a number of listening sessions, because obviously our campus and people were rocked by the developments, and we wanted to create an opportunity for people to be able to kind of process what was going on. But the other piece is, you know, when you just have people talk and you don't do anything with it, that's not very helpful. So we took notes and we asked people not just to process the reaction, but what can we do at UMKC to make this campus a place for a good place for everyone so that we avoid those kinds of things. And from there, we had 148 recommendations that we pulled together into five themes. And then we had a team that has been working on implementing those. And we just had a follow-up listening session the other day, asking people. We reported out on the things that we've accomplished based on the feedback. And we asked people, you know, how did we do? What else can we do? So I think one of the keys, one of the focus of the administration is keep everybody talking and us listening. Not assuming we know all the answers.
And Muhammad, were you aware of those efforts by the administration? Was that well publicized on campus? And if so, what did you make of it?
It was well advertised. So as soon as these sessions were being set up, we were told the Muslim Student Association about them. And then we advertised them to all the students in our organization and to everyone around campus as well. So the administration set it up and then let the organizations know, who further advertised it, as well as the administration's effort to advertise it.
And what was your reaction to the fact the university was giving it this kind of effort? How did that go down with you and your group?
It's one of the things that makes UMKC kind of special versus the other universities. They actually make that effort, from what I've seen, whenever there's been a problem, they step forward to help out. For example, last year when we had a vigil set up for the shootings that happened in Carolina. And so UMKC made an effort to help us set all that up, get the supplies we needed for the vigil, and they did all that in that same day.
So the administration actually helped.
Yeah. So
helped you guys demonstrate, in a sense. Yeah.
Exactly. We went up to them, and they were more than willing to help. They didn't try to block us, and they didn't just say, do whatever you want. They actually went out and got supplies for us.
What would the reaction have been if they had tried to block?
I don't really know. Never really something we've had an issue with, and I don't see it being an issue. But if they weren't supportive, more than likely we still would have held the vigil on campus and then seen what happened after that.
Muhammad, that's called a hypothetical question on behalf of your radio host. And those are always the hardest questions to answer, because you would know the answer to that question, right?
Yep.
So maybe it wasn't the best question. Remy, what did you make of the university's efforts here in Kansas City to reach out to students in the wake of all the aftermath of MU?
Absolutely. I feel incredibly fortunate to be a student at UMKC, because I would refer to our campus as delightfully progressive. The administration we've already discussed how the administration is active in allowing us to demonstrate our right to free speech and share and convene as a community. It's always reassuring that you're not alone. And now more than ever is a time that we feel that it's important to be in solidarity with each other, as part of a community with each other.
That's an interesting phrase, Susan, that Remy just used, this notion of feeling that you're not alone. Is that one of the goals here, just that sentiment that Remy expressed?
Well, absolutely. You mean behind the listening sessions?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So students, when they're by themselves in their apartments or dorm rooms, they're not feeling like they're alone because of who they are.
Absolutely. I think when you're in a university community, we try to have a climate where everyone is welcome and everybody is involved. And so the listening sessions were one way to demonstrate that. Most recently, post-election, they also held sessions called safe space and healing sessions for people who wanted to come and process the reactions to the election or the political changes. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was an openness to all points of view, and we're having one, I think, tomorrow for staff. But again, our approach is always to support and listen. And not just listen, but act. Do something about what we're hearing.
Is all this just a result of the fact, Susan Wilson, that UMKC is located in a major metropolitan community as opposed to a more rural setting in a state like Missouri? Do the two things just go hand in hand?
Well, I do think you're right. You know, we are an urban-serving university. And for that reason, we have a lot of diversity in our student body, both race, religion, sexual orientation, that maybe when you're MU that's out in the middle of Missouri, you don't have.
Yeah.
And so I do think they have some special challenges because of that, both recruiting and retaining minority faculty who may not want to go to Mizzou, as well as just consciousness raising. Because yeah. a lot of times where you grow up is how you see the world in terms of diversity or not.
Yeah.
And so you do have, I think, in the more rural areas, people that may not have been exposed that much to diversity and therefore sometimes don't know how to act or act in ways that are inadvertently not helpful.
We're joined now on the phone by Cordell Pulliam. He's president of the NAACP chapter here at UMKC, and he's the events coordinator for Men of Color. And Cordell, I'm sure glad you could take some time with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me just go right to the bottom line here, Cordell. I'm wondering if you or any members of your group feel excluded in any way from the larger student body because of your color, and I'll ask the others around the table about religion or sexual orientation. What's your response to that, Cordell?
I don't think that here at UMKC I have outwardly ever been excluded. Like Dr. Wilson was saying, we are an urban campus, and we have, I don't think in any way, shape, or form that would go down in an outward way. I think like we have been excluded by our color from being able to do certain things, have certain events, and always there's a covert aura of racism, but it's not like outward, as you would see at Mizzou, where they can put things out there and mm-hmm. be racist because of the rural setting. Here in an urban setting, we're surrounded by a community of a diverse community. The plaza's right here. There's certain things that could never happen here. So we will see classroom racism. We will see graffiti racism. We will see things written down and put on anonymous websites. But I've never mm-hmm. outwardly been stopped from any kind of success, any kind of statements, or any kind of upward mobility because of my race. But it's really a lot of the factors are what Dr. Wilson said, is that we're urban. And so it can't happen in a city without uprising. You know?
Right. Let me ask the same question to Remy Sa, who serves as Secretary of the Pride Alliance again. How about the question, again, the bottom line here, Remy, do you ever feel excluded from the larger student body because of your sexual orientation?
I cannot speak for myself, but members of the community have come up and expressed how they're concerned regarding the climate of the political attitudes of the administration-elect.
You're talking about in Washington, D.C., the Trump administration.
That's correct.
Not the UMKC administration.
Right, right. Yeah. That's correct. Very many people are concerned that what is now the law of the land, marriage equality, mm-hmm. Will be overturned by the induction of new justices or what have you.
But here at UMKC, which right. is where I'm trying to drive here, you're saying what to that?
I'm saying that we're.
I mean, how the administration reacts to students of any sexual orientation.
We've made a lot of progress to show that we are inclusive. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about our university. Mm-hmm. And that we're unabashedly so, I think, speaks to the fact that we are a melting pot and we are representative of what is the entirety of the United States.
Muhammad, how about you?
I'm going to have to go and agree with that on the campus as a whole. They've done everything they can to make everyone feel inclusive.
Yeah.
And just picking back off of what Cordell was saying, with the living in an urban environment, people aren't going to do anything overtly. That has kind of changed a little bit. I've had friends come into a few incidents, my father also. And so that might change just a little bit now.
You're talking about the community that goes well beyond UMKC here.
So in Kansas City as a whole. And then on campus, though, the administration's doing everything they can to make everyone feel safe. For example, they've been letting everyone know that the police officers are available to escort anyone from campus to the parking garage if they feel the need for that. And so they've been doing everything they can to make everyone feel inclusive, especially Muslims. A lot of people or females that wear the hijab is kind of are scared now, and they've had those opportunities given to them to feel safe if they don't.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about UMKC's efforts to make diverse students comfortable on campus and how that compares to other universities. Susan, the university here just completed its most recent campus climate survey, and we don't have the results yet, if I understand correctly, but I want to go back to the one done maybe 10 years ago. How was the climate rated back then?
Well, and that's an interesting point, because sometimes people will say to us, wow, you're doing such a good job, but I think they need to be reminded that part of the reason that we're doing such a good job now is that we did have that climate survey in 2006 that said that the racial climate at UMKC wasn't too good. And so immediately there was a lot of work put into changing that.
What was the issue back then?
Part of it was that African-American students didn't feel comfortable, felt like they weren't able to be as successful at UMKC, felt that the racial climate in the classrooms was not what it should be. We had very few Hispanic students then, and there were criticisms about our efforts to get Hispanic students into UMKC. So as a result of that, UMKC has had, for some years, some level of diversity, office or positions. But this time, after the survey, they made it a cabinet level in the chancellor's cabinet position.
They upgraded the status of the whole thing.
Exactly. And then began to really put more money into it. And then when I came on, one of the things that I said, there was a task force in 2011, the Chancellor's Diversity Task Force, who put together a diversity strategic plan that was part of the strategic plan for the university.
Lots of plans here, Susan.
Yes, and so that was my attitude when I said lots of plans, and you know what plans do. They sit on a shelf.
Right.
So what I commenced to do was I worked with every dean and had them develop an action plan for each school. And then that action plan now is monitored by the Chancellor's Diversity Council. So that's a way of saying we don't just have a plan on a shelf. It's an action plan that all the deans are responsible for implementing.
Do you have any sense of what the more recent campus climate survey is going to show? Because it was heavily advertised on campus, because I worked there and saw lots of encouraging notices to take part and fill it out. Do you have any early results from it yet?
Oh, no. We won't have results until probably March, April. But what I can tell you now is that the response rates among faculty were probably the highest response rates of any group. And, you know, I can't speculate what it'll say. I hope that it reflects the work that we've been doing. But just because we've done a lot of good work doesn't mean we're perfect. And, I'm expecting to see some areas that we might need to work on. And we have a task force put together to follow up on to-dos from that climate survey.
Cordell Pulliam, again, president of UMKC's chapter of the NAACP. You just heard Susan say there were issues a decade ago when it came to how African-American students felt on campus. What are you guessing they're going to say this report's going to show when it does come out in the months to come?
I think, first of all, I want to say that I definitely feel like since that time, there has been a concerted effort to increase our ability to succeed. I have found a lot of success here on the MKC's campus, and I have students who went here in like 06, 07 as friends who have told me about some of the challenges they went through, and there's been a great effort. We've seen a great increase in the resources for the Multicultural Student Affairs Office. I also work with Dr. Wilson in diversity and inclusion, and I see firsthand how they go out of their way in order to bring great speakers of color here to create events and safe spaces for people of color here. And I think those have been great things. We also see great faculty like Dr. Rebecca Davis and Rhiannon Dickerson, who try so hard to include diversity into their not only into their classroom etiquette, but into their curriculum. Dr. Davis teaches a Black civil rights class. Rhiannon Dickerson has brought me to her class, and we've also talked about ways to include diversity into her curriculum as an English teacher teaching the mandatory English classes.
Yeah.
So there's been an effort, and I can see that. But at the same time, I think one of the main complaints is going to be still that the African-American students don't have equal access to resources. There's not a great knowledge of the resources that exist, and that may be the continuing issue. Like, even if we're making all of these efforts and issues and trying to change things, I don't think it's reaching the students well. I make a great effort to be a well-informed student, but a lot of people don't have the same effort that I do in doing that. Therefore, there are a lot of resources out here that they're unaware of, and a lot of things that work for them that they don't even know about. So a lot of times the specific challenges of African-American students are still, you know, greatly societal and sometimes outside of universities, outside of that kind of, you know, realm of control.
Right.
So the things that they deal with leave them unable to get equitable access to information, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I got you, Cordell. Remy, if you could just hop in here. Cordell's saying that some students aren't aware of some of the resources that are available. Is that your understanding as well, or do you see things differently?
I absolutely understand. I absolutely agree with Cordell. He brings up a great point. We have so many. Our student union, which was very recently built, is nothing but resources and things that you can do to move forward. And I think it's important to consider in this discussion regarding the campus climate of our school to consider the alternative of what would a campus look like had the administration not been fully supportive of efforts to, you know, try.
And what's the answer to that question? I'd be curious to know what you say.
You know, I've seen this firsthand. My friend, who goes to another university, also in the Midwest, at this university, they hosted a rally for who is now President-elect Donald Trump. And she did not feel safe. She was a person of color. And while she was trying to make the way from the library to the parking garage, she was harassed. She was spat at. And so when she requested, oh, I would like an escort from the library to my car or something like that, they just didn't have the resources to handle it because they were too busy allocating it to this other event.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Muhammad, Susan, just hang on a second. If you would just comment, Muhammad, on what you'd like to see done on campus that maybe is not being done. Does anything come to mind?
I'd say probably try to figure out ways to make everyone a little bit more involved. So we have these sessions for people come to and people go, but more people can be involved. And it's not something that's the university's fault. It's something that's the students' fault. They don't get involved until they need to. And so if more students get involved and the university goes along with the students trying to get involved, it'll have more conversations come up.
Yeah. You know, Cordell, it's a commuter campus, and I imagine sometimes that doesn't help things very much, does it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking when I was listening to Muhammad's comment. You know, I think that, I mean, we got to think about what we do as students and how hard it is to even be involved. When I tell you that, like, even in the roles that I fill, you know, working in diversity and inclusion and then being the president of Men of Color, being the president of NAACP, being on the Mod Trial team and all these other things that I'm involved in, it takes so much energy and so much effort. And like we were talking about earlier, people's personal lives, people's ability to make money, people's ability to be settled in school, people's ability to even the people that commute, sometimes they just can't afford to stay on campus. Like there's a lot of issues there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to work. Like people work full-time jobs and go to school and they don't have the time to be involved, but still go through the same issues as people that have that time. So being a commuter campus too, like it's just the environment itself is really pick up and go.
Right.
I never, even on my own organizations, I don't blame people or like default their membership because they can't make meetings. And Men of Color has a 42-member, right. It's a 42-member organization. I would say that our meetings regularly host 25 to 30 people.
Wow.
And so like we generally keep up, like we send out, I send a lot of messages and things like that to keep everybody involved, but it takes a community kind of effort.
Right.
So we have to, even as student leaders, I feel like it is our job to make sure that people who don't show up still become informed.
Muhammad, I'm going to have to scoot on here, but Cordell, thank you very much for those comments. I'm going to thank our good guests. We'd be having this conversation if there were big issues. So when there aren't as big issues, it's important to have that conversation as well. I want to thank our guests again, Cordell Pulliam with UMKC's chapter of the NAACP. Muhammad Wakas is with the Muslim Student Organization. Remy Sa serves as Secretary of the Pride Alliance. And Dr. Susan Wilson is UMKC's Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion. Thanks very much, everybody, for a good conversation.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the future. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we were live from the Nelson Atkins to listen in on their latest sound exhibit, and what an extraordinary thing it is, the 40-part motet. Listen to our Festival of Choral Music at kcur.org/uptoday. Tomorrow, Master of Wine Doug Frost and Chef Ted Habiger share their expertise on throwing a holiday party you won't soon forget. That's tomorrow on the show. Well, if you're in business, you need to know something about the future. You need to spot trends so that you don't wake up one day and ask the dreaded question, how did we miss that? In a new book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream, Amy Webb discusses the signs that you should be looking for. She says the future didn't arrive fully formed, but appears on the fringes, but you have to know where to look. Joining us now from New York City by phone is Amy Webb. She's founder of the Future Today Institute. That's a leading future forecasting and strategy firm. Amy, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Your first sentence in this book, the future doesn't simply arrive fully formed overnight. What do you mean by that? The future doesn't arrive overnight.
Well, you know, one of, I think, the most interesting things about new science and technology is that when we first encounter it, it appears as though to us, it's something brand new. And a great example of this is artificial intelligence, which is something everybody's thinking about and talking about now. Artificial intelligence is not new in the year 2016, and actually, it was first posited 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in the late 1800s, mathematician Ada Lovelace, in the footnotes of a paper she was translating, talked about the day that computers may someday think, just like we humans do. So, you know, this is a emergent field that's actually hundreds of years old. And so if you know where to look at the fringe, and if you understand how to spot what's going on, it becomes very apparent that none of the science and technology just shows up, right? It's something that, you know, it's ongoing, and honestly, it builds. And these new trends don't get developed in a vacuum. They are reactions to other things that are going on in society.
That's interesting. Let's talk about your own experience, Amy, with gazing into a crystal ball, which happened to you, in a sense, in Tokyo back in 1997. What happened to you that day?
Sure. Well, I was living in Japan for many years, and I was a journalist at the time, but I also had one foot in computer programming, and I was going to see a hacker friend of mine in the Akihabara district in Tokyo, and he wound up not getting there on time, and so I had wandered into a little shop, and in that shop, I met this very old techie who pulled out of his pocket, from behind the counter, a phone that was capable of sending a text message, which wasn't in itself interesting. What was so interesting about it was that it was a phone that was connected to the internet.
Ah.
And I remember thinking, you know, this was a mobile phone. And this seems sort of ridiculous now, right? Because we're,
right.
I'm talking to you from the middle of New York City, where you can hear sirens behind me on an iPhone.
That's okay. You sound good, Amy.
The miracle of technology. But what's so fascinating is that, you know, that's been more than, it's like 20 years ago. And for me, that was just this moment where, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, wow, this is cool technology. Instead, what a futurist does is to stop and say, what does it mean, right? Sort of mm-hmm. like a scientific approach. So if this phone is connected to the internet, what might that mean? Well, I'm constantly lost. So that might mean that GPS is a part of the phone, and maybe maps are a part of the phone.
Yeah.
And maybe that means that I can do things with the internet, right? And I can look up restaurants, and, you know, suddenly the entire world is in my pocket, literally. It changes everything.
So you were able, you call these things in the book, these hints that you come across, signals. Were you actively recognizing their significance even at that moment when you were in Tokyo, sort of waiting for your friend there?
Well, you know, at that moment, I didn't yet have a framework for what it is that I do now. As a reporter, I was trained to, you know, look under rocks and look at information in ways that maybe other people weren't looking at it. So I think that some of what I had done, some of what was going on then was intuitive. What I know now, since I've been a futurist for the past 11 years, is that having, to some extent, that natural pattern recognition that developed as a result of my job as a journalist, combined with asking a lot of questions, you know, looking for evidence, looking for patterns, you know, all of that eventually coalesces into understanding in a much more concrete way the potential future scenarios that are ahead.
Even then, you know, one thing that was amazing to me, you talk about in the book, Amy, is a really successful guy like the co-founder of BlackBerry completely missed the new wave of iPhone technology. This guy was caught utterly flat-footed. You wonder sometimes, how can that happen?
Well, you know, that's something that I go to into a lot of detail
yes.
in the book, and it's something I call the paradox of the present. And, you know, we all sort of, BlackBerry is the company that everybody loves to chide, I think, now, but we're quick to forget that it was also one of the world's fastest growing and most successful companies, even to this day, although it's certainly not successful in the year 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So how would a founder of one of the most successful technology companies of all time have missed the next significant trend in his own field, in mobile phones? And the answer is pretty simple. When you're successful, you know, what's fascinating is that paradoxically, the most successful CEOs and leaders tend to be the ones who miss the next great thing.
Huh.
And that's because, you know, they're very successful. Their technology is doing well. They're surrounded by risk managers. Risk managers don't like to experiment. You know, as a result of that, they are not scrappy. They're not continually looking back to the fringe, to places where new technology is being developed. And that's a, you know, it seems odd, but in a way, we see this happen again and again. And it's especially, that's why it's so important for, especially those leaders who are quite successful, to engage and use the tools of a futurist so that the same thing doesn't happen to them, to their products, their services, and their industries.
We're talking about the future with futurist Amy Webb. She's the author of a new book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy, when you talk about the fringe, you're talking about what exactly?
So the fringe is the fringe is that place where academics are still tinkering around, they're still researching. They are doing pre-publication, maybe it's like pre-publication research, but it's also online communities like Reddit,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you have a whole bunch of people who are trolls, you know, in some cases, and other people who are maybe not really friendly. But Reddit is also a rich forum for people who are asking these critical questions, and they're also trying to figure out what's next, and they're experimenting. There are DIY biohacker labs now all over the world where people are experimenting with, you know, biotechnologies, right? So it's in these places where, you know, maybe 90% of what comes out, the output is maybe not going to manifest as a bona fide trend to pay attention to, but that's not the point. The point when you're looking at the fringe is to try to understand, you know, where are there connections and relationships between actors, between organizations, people, research that maybe we didn't see before. And through those connections, we start looking at patterns to understand, you know, what might come next.
And maybe the central point of your book, Amy, is that if you're in any position of leadership in this country, whether it's any kind of business leadership, higher education leadership, you've got to be monitoring the future. That sort of goes hand in hand with what your job responsibilities are all about.
Well, that's right. And, you know, so for 11 years at my company, you know, we do this work. We do this forecasting work, which is evidence-based, data-driven, and requires, you know, modeling. We do this on behalf of Fortune 50 companies and the government agencies and so forth. But at this point in time, given where we are with various things in the world, you know, I feel very, very strongly that the skills that I have as a futurist should be democratized. I find it fascinating that every business leader is expected to know how to read a profit and loss sheet, like a P&L. And yet those same people aren't required and maybe they don't even have the desire to have the skills as a futurist that I do. And to me, you know, that's just as dangerous and problematic, you know, as a leader not knowing how to read a budget.
Yeah.
So the reason that I wrote this book is because I truly believe, and not just business leaders, but really, you know, this is what I describe in the book. There are six steps, and you know, in a sense, it's a bit like, it's a bit like learning any new skill.
Mm-hmm.
It won't take you long to read the book, you know? And once you read the book, you'll have a basic understanding of what I do and what a futurist does and how to do it. And then it's a matter of practicing it. And that's something that anybody can do.
Amy, just a final point. I mean, what is a futurist? Because you make the point of saying in here that your job does not involve spreading prophecies. But I thought that's exactly what futurists did.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like a crazy made up job title, which I totally understand. You know, so futurism as an academic profession goes back more than 100 years. And it is the intersection of the hard sciences and the social sciences. So for those of us who practice this professionally, you know, we have my background is in economics, game theory, and political science, and then also computer science, right? And there are futurists who, you know, are theoretical physicists, who also have, you know, that they know about, you know, they may be academics in theoretical physics, but they also have degrees in psychology and, you know, other fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a multidisciplinary field, and it is not at all about making predictions or about sort of gazing out onto the landscape and scanning newspaper articles to try to make sense of the world. Those of us who do this professionally, that is not what we do. And we don't stand on stage and make grand proclamations that, you know, that sound like they're from sci-fi fiction novels. You know, this is very serious work. And for people, especially, and it's great. It's a great field, by the way, for anybody who, like me, got interested in a lot of different subjects at once. And if I could have majored in five different things in college, I probably would have done that. It would have taken me much longer. My parents would not have been happy about it.
Well, Amy Webb is the author of the new book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Thanks for joining us from the heart of New York City, Amy. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
I've always had the hope that on the day I go to heaven, Heavenly Father will shake my hand and say, "You've done an awesome job, Kevin. Now it's our time to go out and set the world's people free. And we can do it together, you and me, but mostly me."
Well, look who's here. mostly me, mostly him himself, Brian McTavish, yeah. who talks about cool stuff to do on the weekends. And how are you, man? Good to see you.
I am very excited about this weekend.
There's a lot of things happening. And it begins tonight with Chiefs and Raiders, and people are fired up. And then there's the Book of Mormon that's here in town,
that's
too.
That's right. Okay, I'm going to predict the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Chiefs
can't do it.
Win
you
tonight.
Think? You think?
Yes. I am basing this on all of the knowledge I've accumulated over the years as a Chiefs fan, even though I don't go to the games anymore.
That's right. You used to go all the time.
Maybe that means I'll go to the games next year and they'll be Super Bowl champs. But they're going to take it tonight.
Good.
And that's not even officially part of the weekend to-do list.
Right.
Let's get on top of this. You mentioned it. The Book of Mormon.
The Book of Mormon.
The 9-time Tony Award-winning...
I hear great things about it.
Oh, musical comedy from the creators of South Park. That's Trey Parker and Matt Stone. They're so talented. It's on stage tonight and Friday and all through the weekend. These two guys, Parker and Stone, they're very comfortable in this musical realm, Steve, because as you may recall, in 1999, they gave the world a South Park movie with a title I don't think I'm going to repeat on the air.
Okay.
But it was one of the best movie musicals I've ever seen.
Wow.
Okay. And then just a few years ago, on an episode of South Park, you know, it's about all the kids, almost a satire of the Peanuts gang.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a new kid who moves into town. He happens to be Mormon. And they proceed to ridicule him for his Mormon beliefs and this, that, and the other thing. But by the end of the show, it's actually very sweet because the lesson is, hey, you know what? It's good to be yourself. And if you're trying to do something positive and productive in this world, whether you're Mormon or whoever you may be, for whatever reason, go do that thing. It's very sweet. And I think that sentiment runs through, along with some explicit language, the Book of Mormon.
All right.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling, you and me, every son of liberty.
That's a song from World War One, which is the point of this next little piece.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's actually the voice of George M. Cohen, who wrote and recorded Over There, and Johnny Get Your Gun, and so on and so forth, back in 1917. That was one of the big tunes during World War One. And this weekend...
I didn't know. It's been 10 years.
10 years.
Since the World War One Museum here in Kansas City opened up, and what an amazing thing.
It's an amazing thing.
I was there for the opening. It was great. My kids were there, too.
And it's only gotten more interesting over the...
It's a great museum.
Absolutely.
Just love that place.
So here's the thing. Free admission this weekend.
Wow.
Free admission today through Sunday at the National World War One Museum and Memorial. All day, today, Friday, Saturday,
Sunday.
You'll
learn something and you'll enjoy doing it.
Oh, yeah. And go to the website because they have a whole bunch of special added anniversary attractions to take advantage of.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 free or almost free things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
Tonight is Hanukkah. Got everything we need. A frying pan, some oil, and a latke recipe. Let's celebrate our ancestry. We've got, the latke recipe.
What do we have here?
Okay. Yes. Well, we got your latke over here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then over there, we got your hamantash, okay? Now, which is better, the pancake-ish potato latke?
Latke.
Wait a minute.
I'm done.
Hold on.
Right there. That's all it takes.
Oh, well, let me continue. Okay, you're right, the latke. But anyway, because it's so good. It's a meal in itself.
It is.
But is it the latke, for argument's sake, or the cookie-like hamantash, that tri-cornered filled cookie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is going to be debated in formal, hilarious fashion during the great latke hamantash debate. It takes place at 11:30 Sunday morning at White Theater. It's on the Jewish Community Campus in Overland Park. You're going to have two teams of debaters, three on a side, okay? And they're going to use philosophy and technology and ridiculous over-the-top props to prove their points. Is it going to be the latke or is it going to be the hamantash? And then, after they've done their best...
You get to eat some.
Oh, you get to eat some. Let me tell you. That's why God gave us two hands.
I'm meant to just
stuff it in. And plus, you're going to have a 3-rabbi panel that will actually, at least for this year, decide which holiday treat is better.
Okay.
Okay.
That's coming up on Sunday.
I'm hungry. I'm so hungry.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Let's talk Dr. Seuss.
Yes, and I think you were smiling a big un-Grinch-like smile, yes, during that tune. That's actually Thurl Ravenscroft. Mr. Wow. Ravenscroft is doing that wonderful bass vocal on "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch."
Pretty good vocal.
And that, yeah, I tell you, one of my faves. It hit me right between the Christmas time eyes in 1966 when it was that big special on CBS.
Yeah, what is it about Dr. Seuss? I mean, the Grinch was kind of creepy.
Kinda.
He was rotten to the core.
I didn't
like that guy. I did not like him.
Well,
yes, I am. I did not like him because he was mean.
Oh, you're mixing up your Dr. Seuss.
Yeah,
I love
it. I am, but I didn't like
him. Okay, nobody likes Scrooge in A Christmas Carol until he finds redemption, right?
Yeah.
Then you just get out the hanky. You cry tears of joy. So it is with the Grinch. He's a Scrooge-like character.
Seuss was on one hand fascinating, on the other hand kind of scary, on the other hand intriguing. He just managed to combine all those things and all that stuff.
And you have just combined in one fell sentence
the
appeal of Dr. Seuss.
I cut to the core.
You did, if not the quick.
Yeah.
Celebrate Whoville holidays, including the Grinch, hopefully reformed. He'll be there Saturday and Sunday at the Kansas City Market from 10 to 1:30. The previous Friday evening, watch the cartoon show, watch the live-action movie. And also, don't forget the visit with the fairy princess at the Kansas City Museum this week. And so much to do for kids and families.
And finally today,
I was born in Louisiana, down on the Ohio.
I like this group.
Oh, Ray Benson.
I like him.
Ray Benson has been leading Asleep at the Wheel, the traditional country and western swingers from down Texas way, since they got going in 1969, Steve.
I didn't know it's been that long.
He is still standing. He has not left the bandstand, Steve.
Wow.
Okay, his cowboy boots are nailed to that bandstand. You can check him out and maybe shine his boots if he'll let you at 8 o'clock tonight at Knucklehead Saloon. It's a special Merry Christmas, y'all, from Texas concert.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, buddy.
Tomorrow,
Go Chiefs.
Master of Wine, Doug Frost, and Chef Ted Habiger join us tomorrow with tips on making your next holiday party one to remember. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Ryan Hennessy. Our senior producer, that's Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.